The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, so here's the deal. I'm going to talk very generally for about 10 minutes or so. And then Professor Romeo will talk for as long as he wants to talk. Among other things, he will probably give you a list of specific courses that he would recommend, and then I'll follow and give you my specific list of courses, and then we will be happy to take questions. After we are done, I guess two or possibly three of the Dean's Fellows will come in and tell you whatever it is they want to tell you. Now, I think I mentioned to you in class a couple of weeks ago when I was giving you some notice of this session. You should get as much advice as you possibly can from as many people you respect as you possibly can. Don't rely too much on student advice regarding which courses you should take. Second, third, and fourth year students don't have all that much experience with different courses and why to take different courses and what sorts of jobs out there are expected to have taken different courses. On the other hand, you will probably get better advice, with a few exceptions, you will probably get better advice from the Dean's Fellows about which professors to take. So rely on the professors regarding courses, perhaps rely on the students regarding professors. And maybe the best advice you can get from students is not which professors to take, but which professors to avoid. Students know that. And we can talk about student evaluations in a while as well. So it seems to me that your goal, even if you came here knowing that you wanted to be an X type of lawyer, your goal should be to keep open as many options as possible for as long as possible. Meaning, you should take a good, broad, general array of courses until you decide, it's an informed decision, until you decide that you want to specialize. In terms of what courses to take, among other things, you need to consider, when do you take courses? There are a fair number of courses that most students should and do take, but not necessarily in the same order. When should you take some of the courses that we're going to say are basically foundational courses? And the answer to that, of course, as Miklos would tell you, is it depends. If you know or you think you know that you want to move in a certain area, you came here knowing that you want to be a skills requirement, and this will be my last point, I would say the clinics certainly satisfy the skills requirement. The trial practice courses, I forget what the order is, we offer criminal trial practice, I think, in the fall, and civil trial practice in the spring. Both of those will satisfy the skills requirement. Appellate advocacy will satisfy the skills requirement. And then I think, as Professor Robin said, individual professors will be identifying their own courses and getting them approved to satisfy the skills requirement as well. And so you want to keep track of that and sort of look for what you think is the best way to do that, because it is something that you need. So I guess I'll stop there and let you add courses or dispute the courses I offered, and or both, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, I'm going to be quick and I'm going to be specific. I've got three categories of courses. Courses that are on the must list, courses that are on the probably list, and basically a category C that is possible. Okay, category A, must list. I call these the non-required required courses or the required electives. It seems to me that you can't be a well-rounded lawyer without these three courses: evidence, business associations, federal personal income tax. Just about everybody takes them. we might as well require them. It would be easier for the registrar administratively if we just require these. Almost 95% of the students take these. Category B, at least a third to a half of the students take these courses. Remedies. Remedies is private law. It is that portion of your torts, contracts, and properties casebook that you didn't have time to reach when you took torts, contracts, property.
And con law, the way some of the faculty teach you.
Chicken, I thought you were just the only one.
Remedies?
No, for con law.
No, I mean that it includes part of con law. Thank you.
Okay, remedies, I think, is an important course if you know you're going to be or hope to be in a practice where you're going to be doing a lot of private law towards contracts, property, certainly con law, but we do have courses that deal with some remedies in the constitutional area as well. Okay, so remedies. Federal courts, I think, is a very important course, especially if you're interested in criminal law, but even if you're not and you're going to be practicing in Washington, seems to me federal courts is a nice course to have. Even just to be a good citizen these days, to know the abuses of government and how to counter the abuses of government. That's what this course is really all about, and we have wonderful Fed courts teachers. Seems to me, also in Category B, which is not must, but probably, unless you have a good reason not to do it, I'd say everybody should have a uniform commercial code course beyond contract. I did not. I don't care that I didn't. But it seems to me that other people should have it. And that would be either negotiable instruments or sales or secured transactions. And sometimes we offer sales and secured transactions as a combined course. Sometimes we offer it separately. Seems to me most people should have a forensic course like trial practice or appellate advocacy, either of which would satisfy the new skills requirement or moot court. Now, some people would put wills and trusts on this list. I would not. It's not on my A list, it's not on my B list, it's not on my C list. And I don't have anything lower than a C list. There's only one reason to take wills and trusts, and that is that you want to be a wills and trusts lawyer. There is no other good reason. You might think, okay, I should take wills and trusts because I'm going to be in a small or medium-sized general civil law firm. Well, you may be, but there's going to be a wills and trusts expert. If you want to be that expert, take the course. If you don't do it. I wrote my own will about 15 years ago. I am really glad it never had to be tested.
My good will was more than one.
I don't see a good reason to take that course. I really don't. Administrative law, there are a lot of people on this faculty who would put that course on their A list or not lower than their B list. I'm not one of them. We have a lot of administrative law teachers on this faculty, which explains why a lot of faculty put it on their A or B list. But I think Professor Wormuel is right. If you're going to be practicing federal law in Washington, you should have the course. If you're going to be practicing government contracts law, very lucrative, a lot of lawyers do it in Washington, you need the course. If you're going to practice with an agency in Washington, take the course. Otherwise, you know, that's one course among dozens upon dozens of others that you might consider, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that high on the list. I guess two more points. My category C is not about courses at all. Follow professors. If there's a professor you like or professors you hear from your classmates or from other classes that they really like for one reason or another, follow the professor. And I guess I have two more points. Professor Wormuel talked about evidence in terms of sequencing, evidence as a prerequisite or prerequisite. Some courses, whether it's clinical or whatever, say you need evidence, some of it, if you need evidence as a prerequisite. Others
say it's okay to take it as a co-requisite. Our trial practice classes or trial advocacy, criminal trial advocacy, civil trial advocacy, say it's a co-requisite. I don't buy it. It seems to me if you really want to do well in trial advocacy, or you really want to do well in the clinic, even if evidence is listed as a co-requisite, take it before anyway. I would really hate to go to court on behalf of a live client in a clinic and make my argument and not find out until a week later in evidence what my objection should have been.
It seems to me to be a much more effective lawyer in those settings if you had evidence.
And one other thing, in terms of choosing courses, choosing professors, you know that at myamerican.edu you can find the numerical evaluation. You know that, yes? Okay. Let me just give you my take on the evaluation. We have from a low of 1 to a high of 5. There are a lot of good professors at this school. There are a lot of people who get not just higher than 4, but higher than 4.5. Okay. Just because a professor gets higher than 4.5 doesn't mean the professor is a great teacher. It may mean that the professor just lays it all out and spoon feeds you, and students appreciate that. So if you see 4.5 or better, now discount it a little bit, take it with a grain of salt. The real value of the evaluations for the students is at the lower end. If you see that a professor is getting lower than 2 from a large class, or lower than 2.5, or regularly lower than a 3, no matter what, there is some problem there. There is a problem. You should avoid the course. You should avoid the teacher. You should avoid that teacher. I think that's all I have to say. We will take your questions and then turn it over to the Dean's Fellows, who will make their presentation and take other questions. Okay? So, questions. 1, 2.
I was just wondering if you could repeat the UCC courses.
Negotiable instruments, sales, which is like advanced contracts, Article 2, and secure transactions, which is Article 9 of the UCC.
Regarding the evidence, do you discourage taking that at the same time as criminal and civil procedure?
That's a good question. No, I wouldn't. Evidence and criminal procedure are totally unrelated. The criminal procedure course you're going to take is like an advanced con law class. What you will study is 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendment. You won't learn how to do things, not criminal process. This is constitutional criminal procedure. So evidence, there's almost no overlap between evidence and criminal procedure 1. As between evidence and civil procedure, I don't see a problem either. They're both remedial courses. There are 3, evidence, civil procedure, conflict of laws, and some other advanced courses are remedial in the sense that you don't get substantive law. These are just the house rules, the rules that make other rules. There's not a lot of overlap between evidence and civil procedure. So there's no reason not to take evidence as next semester when you'd be taking civil procedure.
What point is it necessary, or is a liability, not to have a specialization or some degree of focus as to what you want to do? Is it a bad thing if you graduate taking a really wide range of courses and not a lot of stuff in depth beyond that?
I mean, I don't think it's a problem if you're going to end up in a firm and not have a particular area of specialization. I think there are many, many, many lawyers that would fall into that category. The question is sort of, you know, are you cheating yourself out of the satisfaction of concentrating on something that you might really like or enjoy and haven't discovered yet? But I don't think it would keep you from being able to practice.
Adding to that a little bit, when I said it's a good idea to keep your options open, that doesn't mean to take just one course in 20 different areas. Maybe in 10 areas you take a second or even a third course in some of them, so that your options are open in the sense that you can move into 6, 7, or 8 different directions after you graduate.
I'm a great believer in doing a judicial clerkship after graduation, state or federal. They don't look for specialists, they look for generalists. Very often people don't decide to commit themselves to a certain area until they're in the clerkship, and their judge gives them that extra year of education, serves as a mentor, and guides them in a particular direction. So I don't think you should feel at all guilty, certainly not at this early date, feeling that you want to be, or at least right now you know you are, a generalist. On the other hand, at some point you have to apply for jobs, so which ones do you apply for? All of them, and then accept half of them. That's okay. Okay, question?
You had talked about federal courts being sort of a prerequisite for any judicial clerkship, particularly federal ones. Are there any other courses that, if you're looking toward a clerkship down the line, that should sort of be taken?
You know, it's a good question. It sort of does depend on whether you're more interested in a state or federal clerkship, a trial court, or appellate court clerkship. If you knew you wanted to clerk in a federal court, I'd say the two essential courses are federal courts and post-conviction remedies. Because federal judges do habeas corpus all the time. Habeas corpus is difficult. Many of them don't know it really well, and they would like nothing better than to have a law student come to them saying, I know habeas corpus. I've written a 30 or 40 page paper on habeas corpus. Note that Professor Wormiel is right. Taking these courses may well help you get the clerkship. You apply for clerkships in August of the year, right before your last year of school. You can put in your cover letter, even if you haven't had these courses yet, you can put in your cover letter that you plan to take post-conviction remedies and federal courts in your last year of law school. Okay? If you don't get any interviews, or you get a couple of interviews but no offers, then don't take the courses. Judges don't care. I mean, they want generalists. They want people who know a lot about a lot of things and are well-read and good writers.
And certainly are not looking for, you're not going to get a clerkship because you have three communications law courses and the judge is looking for a communications law specialist. I don't think I've ever heard of that really happening.
On the other hand, there are some specialty courts, tax court, bankruptcy court, and if you knew that you want to move in that direction, the more courses you've had in that area, the more desirable you would be for the bankruptcy judge or the tax court judge. If you want to clerk for an administrative law judge, guess what course you really need. Okay, other questions?
Nuts and bolts question here. A number of the courses I'm interested in start at 4:30 p.m., which is unacceptable for me because I'm a clerk at 5. Is there any way to, and they either offer at 4:30 or at 9 in the morning, so is there any way to basically have it moved to a later point?
They probably wouldn't move that course, but if there are enough people who are interested, if you could get a little petition, or don't call it a petition, it sounds so confrontational, you get people to sign a letter that says, we're all part-timers, we can't get here until 6 o'clock, can you offer another section of this course? They would take that seriously. But you've got to
start that with the particular professors, or should
no, professors don't really have a say in that. You bring it to the dean of students and the two academic associate deans, Niles and Farley, because if there's nobody on the full-time faculty who would teach it, they could go out and find an adjunct to teach it.
I mean, at this point, you need to think about logistically what you're trying to accomplish. If this is something that you actually want to try to take next semester, then it's not likely that they would move it because people have already registered for it at the time that it's listed. So you're trying to persuade them to add another section. If your hope is for a year from now to have them change the time, then that's sort of a different logistic. You might be able to persuade them that if they're going to offer just the one section, it's not fair to pretend that 4:30 is actually is actually going to be convenient to people in the evening program.
You know, one other thing occurs to me that we should have mentioned. As
graduate students at American University, you are entitled to take, for a part of your 86 credits, up to 6 graduate credits elsewhere in the university and have them count toward your law degree. Not the grade. The grade wouldn't carry over, but as long as you pass the course, up to 6 credits, which means 2 courses worth, would count or could count toward your 86 credits if there are some other types of prospective courses that you want to take on the main campus. It depends. Somebody on the law faculty has to certify that the course you're interested in taking from the main campus is actually related to your primary course of study. And so the registrar tends to come to me with students who want to take criminal justice course on the main campus. And I'll certify almost anything as long as it's related. For example, if you know you want to practice criminal law in New York, Florida, Texas, or California, I'll certify a graduate level Spanish, because that'll certainly be related to your primary course of study. We do have some limits on what we would grant. Now, if you're interested in sports law, we won't certify bowling. I know tennis may be bowling. It is really hard for part-time or full-time first-year students to get paying law jobs in the first summer.
So what should you do?
Well, you should try to get something that's relevant that'll give you additional legal education as well as a line on your resume. But don't sell yourself for free. Don't give 40 or 50 hours for free. If nobody's going to pay you, but they will offer you some hours, then do it part-time to get the education and get the money, or get the education and get the resume line, and then do something non-law related, waiter, waitress, construction job, whatever, to get some money if that's what you need. If you're in a fortunate position of not needing the money, then do 2 different volunteer positions. Go intern for a judge. That'll look great. But it's really unrealistic for first-year students to get wonderful paid positions. And if that's your expectation, you're going to be frustrated. On the other hand, if your expectations are really low and you happen to get something that'll pay you $100 a week, you really wouldn't be pretty happy about it. Maybe one more question, and then we'll turn it over. Yes.
Just a quick question. With the assumption that I have no idea what I want to do, of the 3 transactions courses that you talked about earlier, which would be the best?
What would be
the secure transactions, sales, or the UCC courses?
You know, that's a really good question. It depends. If your contracts class spend a fair amount of time in Article 2, then maybe you don't need the sales course, which is like advanced Article 2. Article 9, secure transactions, is something that I think most lawyers don't know about and will have to face from time to time. Negotiable instruments is really banking, how checks, like electronic checks and that sort of stuff, and PayPal and the equivalent now move through the system. For people who are interested in criminal law, I say, take a UCC course, and that course should probably be negotiable instruments, because when you're talking about fraud and larceny, here is where you learn the intricate ways in which the frauds and the larcenies occur. So probably, if you think you want to take one of them, see Professor Snyder, and because he's taught 2 of those courses, and tell him what your interests are, and ask him what he would advise. You had Snyder last semester, right? Oh, you did. Well, good, then. He'll be happy to talk.
Even though we said don't take courses just because they're on the bar exam, I actually think that taking a UCC-related course, if you've never had any exposure to the UCC, can be helpful with the bar exam, because a lot of bars test negotiable instruments questions or other kinds of UCC questions. And if you've never had any exposure to it whatsoever, it's a little harder to really get what you need from the bar review course. It's not to say it can't be done, and lots of people
fine on that part of the bar without ever having taken a semester-long course. But I think it's harder because it's sort of a whole new area that you don't know anything about. You want to minimize the number of those kinds of areas that you have to deal with on the bar.
I'm sure I got 0 points on the UCC question on the New York bar. You don't have to ace the bar. The bar is pass-fail. As soon as I saw it was a UCC question, I didn't write anything.
I went to
the next question to make sure I would maximize my points there. But still a good idea probably to take eight. But not because it's on the bar. It's part of being a lawyer. You want to be, before you want to be a tax lawyer or a criminal lawyer or an international lawyer, first be a lawyer. And there are certain courses that, in my opinion, you need to take to be a well-rounded lawyer. Okay, we're done. We'll turn it over. We probably went longer than we should have. If you have any follow-up questions, Professor Wormiel will be around tomorrow.
Professors Wormiel and Robbins really did cover everything that was on our outline to talk about, so I want this more to be focused on your questions about professors, about specific classes that we've taken, things that perhaps you were not excited about asking with the professors in the room. And there are just a couple of things that are on our general course selection outline that I wanted to emphasize and add a little bit that Professors Wormiel and Robbins didn't cover, and then we'll open up for questions. We only have this room per the schedule for about another 20 minutes, so this really should just take a few minutes, and then we'll do some questions. You guys obviously have a lot of things going on, so we'll get you out of here as soon as possible. One thing that I did want to mention that the professors mentioned but I think is really important is just the fact that when you're registering for your courses next semester, those of you who are staying in the part-time program have a little bit less to worry about here because most of your time will be taken up by your two requirements that you have to take in the fall of your second year anyway, which are criminal procedure and civil procedure. I think you probably all know from the information that's been in the docket about registration that you can register for any civil procedure section. So for those of you who have some time flexibility, you could take a civil procedure section during the day if you wanted to. Criminal procedure during the day if you wanted to. Sorry about that. But your Civ Pro will be at night, and you'll all be together in the same section again. That said, those of you who do have a little bit more flexibility in your choices for next semester if you're switching divisions, if you don't get all the courses that you want for next semester, don't freak out. You guys have the worst priority for registration this time just because of where you are in school. It's not going to be a problem. There is going to be plenty of room in classes. You'll see that classes will fill up right away at the beginning of registration. Tons of people will move things around, drop classes over the summer. Some people who are here now will transfer. Some people will, just be doing other things. Whatever the reason happens to be, there's often space that opens up over the summer or right during the drop ad period. So if you don't happen to get the courses you want right away, don't worry about it too much. You'll have plenty of time to get into the classes that you want as you go forward. I also wanted to mention that specifically related to the question that you had about courses that are scheduled early in the afternoon and it sort of being too late at this point to get a group of people together and ask the deans if the section might be moved to a later time. If you are interested in taking a look at perhaps either this spring schedule or previous spring schedules, previous fall schedules, you might get a better sense of what courses are going to be taught in the upcoming semester after this one to give you a little bit more lead time for that sort of thing. So take a look at those old schedules. If it looks like there are courses that you're going to be interested in that are taught at times when they wouldn't be accessible to continuing evening students, then you'll at least have a little bit more time to get those things together. I also wanted to mention Professor Robbins talked a lot about the seminar opportunities. One thing that we like to mention in our panels is that those courses are great. They give you a good opportunity to get closer to professors, get closer to your classmates, and actually learn a lot of information very in-depth about a particular focus topic. But do take care, because taking a two-credit seminar doesn't mean at all that it's going to be half the work of a four-credit class. Those classes can be a lot of reading. You know, if you're going to end up writing a 30 or 35 or 40-page paper, that's going to take up a lot of time at the end of the semester. So I would say if you're taking multiple seminars, just take care not to overload yourself with classes that you're not going to be able to keep up in. It might seem intuitively like a four-credit class is going to be more work, but you know, it could be 20 or 25 pages of reading per class period, as opposed to, you know, perhaps 50 or 60 or 75 pages of reading per class period for a seminar, depending on how many people there are, how much you cover, and who your professor is. In that same vein, if you have questions about seminars, you should be able to locate the old syllabi in the previous semester schedules or on Blackboard. That's a good way to get a sense of how much work class is actually going to be and what the professor is going to cover in what format. So just before you sign up for a whole bunch of seminars, if you're taking, you know, if you have two credit spaces to fill in, just make sure you have a good sense of how the class is going to run. I did also want to mention there was a question about taking evidence at the same time as CrimPro, which Professor Robbins, I think, thought was perfectly okay. I think from a substantive standpoint, that's also perfectly okay, but I would caution overloading your schedules. You all have to take CrimPro in the fall semester. So if you were going to do that, you figure you would be taking CrimPro, CivPro, evidence, and potentially something else all at the same time, and that would be a pretty tough schedule. You know, those are all, with the exception of CrimPro, all four-credit courses, and that would make for a tough semester. In fact, I'm not sure you could even, as a continuing evening student, you couldn't take CrimPro, evidence, and CivPro all at the same time, because that would be 12 credits. So for those of you who switch divisions, it might be a possibility. The thing that I'm trying to get across is just to try to space things out, to mix it up a little bit with four, 3 and 2 credit courses. There's some 1 credit courses out there, but just to try not to overload your schedules. Fall is a particularly busy time for those of you who participated in short write-on and will write on to journals, or those of you who grade on over the summer. You're going to have at least 160 hours of journal work or so to do during the fall semester. Many of you also, particularly those of you who are switching divisions, have fall recruitment to worry about. So that not only will take up some of your time over the summer, but also will eat up a big chunk of time at the beginning of the fall semester when you do your interviews. So basically, just keep in mind that there's going to be a whole lot of stuff going on in the fall semester of your second year. That, I think, was the busiest time for me so far in law school, and this semester has been a pretty close second. So I would say just sort of keep those things in mind as you're picking your courses. Obviously, you have to, you know, take a certain number of credits, but remember, too, that you'll have a lot of other stuff going on as well. I think those were the only specific things that I wanted to add. I was kind of amazed as we were going through this. I didn't talk with Professors Romila and Robbins at all about what we wanted to cover, and they basically destroyed my entire outline. So I think it was great. I can't imagine that it could have gone any better. So unless you guys have anything in particular you'd like to add, let's do 15 minutes worth of questions and then close it up.
I just have one thing. In terms of what you need to know when you get to a job, anything you need to know, do your job, you can learn there, and you will learn there. So there's no curriculum or no class schedule that's necessary for any job you're going to go into. And and the best human rights lawyer is the best lawyer, the best corporate lawyer is the best lawyer, the best family law divorce attorney is the best lawyer. And so the ultimate goal is to pass the bar and get a job. So I wouldn't necessarily discount taking classes because for purposes of taking the bar exam as much as the professors did. I would take classes that are going to make you a well-roundly good lawyer, and there's no degree of specialization or anything that is necessary for any job or any going into any field, because you can learn, you will learn pretty much everything you need to know on the job anyway, regardless of how much you specialize here. So
yeah, and it's for those of you who have been working already, you may have better ideas of a particular field that you'd like to specialize in rather than someone who's just come straight out of college and doesn't have any sense of how that goes. Some people do, some people don't. But in those sorts of circumstances, I think you might be better positioned to pick something, but still, you know, make sure that you take classes across the board so that you've covered everything that will make you an effective practitioner when you're finished.
I would just jump in and introduce ourselves for those of you that we don't know already.
No, there's no time for that.
Okay, well, I'll introduce all three of us then. This is Scott. He's an evening student. He's been your dean's fall semester. I'm Haley. I was an evening student in my first year, and now I'm a full 10-day student. And this is Eric, who's been a day student. So in terms of planning schedules for different times that you'll be in this building or how long you use this building, we have a variety of experiences, so ask questions directly to us or to all of us, and I'm sure we have different perspectives. We had our first one over here a couple minutes ago.
I had a question. As far as registering for classes, if you're switching divisions, do we register with the part-time people, or do we register as like a second-year full-time?
Did you apply to transfer divisions?
Right, yeah, I already got the provisional.
Okay, then you register with full-time students.
Okay, thanks.
Which is, what?
I believe it's Monday all day, and the schedule is in today's docket.
It's based on the last digit of your AU ID number, and the breakdown of when each group goes is in the docket.
Yep. Yellow shirt.
So then if we switch last semester, then we can go ahead and register as full-time students?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because you're in the full-time program now.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
I was just wondering if any of you either had professors or know professors that you would tell
us definitely not safe. I would say from my perspective, it's easier if you tell me what course you're thinking of taking than me, like, generally talking about professors. I don't know that there are any professors that I haven't heard good things about. For every professor, I mean, that sounds a little canned, but for every professor that a lot of people don't like, there's always one place. And it's kind of amazing. We don't really know how it happens, but it always happens. So I don't have any, like, list of bad professors. But for certain subjects, you'll get different experiences with different professors, and we're happy to talk about that. You want to do the calling on Google? Go ahead.
Well, then, just to talk about, it appears for criminal procedure for people in the evening program, there seems to be three professors, and they're all non-tenure track, which is kind of scary for me.
Who are they?
Pan, Bear, and Barbara. Barbara?
Barbara. They teach together.
Oh, they do?
Bear and Barbara should be listed
that's
next
just one,
to each other.
Yeah, they are. That's, okay, so it's just those two and then someone named Pan.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I had criminal procedure in the fall, and I started in Florence Pan's class and had to transfer out of it because it took up my free block to work with you guys on Tuesday and Thursdays. So that was the only reason I left her class. I enjoyed it at the beginning. I did get the sense, though, from my short time in that class, I think I was only there during the drop ad period. She's a relatively new professor. She was a federal prosecutor and is a very, very nice, very smart woman. But she had some trouble controlling the class discussion, at least at the beginning of the semester. I heard, although I didn't experience the rest of the semester, that continued. That class got a little bit out of hand a couple of different times, and some people had trouble with it. I couldn't say if she's improved in that regard or what, but if that's something that is of concern to you, then you might just keep that in mind. That's all I know about Pam. But she really, you know, the time that I spent in that class was fine. I ended up switching into a day section because I work part-time, so I have a little bit more flexibility there. But I had, I ultimately had Elise Graham, who was fantastic.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about Pam. You should realize that the people who are going to be in the evening sections are going to be a lot of you guys and a few daytime students who are accommodating other schedules for other reasons. So the professors are at a little bit of a disadvantage, especially you'll see that in your civil procedure class when you walk in and 100 of you know each other and they walk in and they don't know anything about any of you. The first person who raised their hand in our civil procedure class this year, the entire room erupted in laughter. He was the person who raised his hand first every time. And the professor was like, please let me in on the joke. This is going to be a long semester. So please recognize when you're registering for evening classes that are required, like criminal procedure, you're going to know the people in your class. So that makes everything a little bit easier. You already have like a set of people to share notes with and study with. Professor Pan, from what I've heard, and I didn't have her either, was at a very big disadvantage for that exact reason. I think that her class got a little out of hand.
And that's why
she seems a little soft-spoken.
Yeah.
So if you're someone who is best motivated by the Socratic method, by being a little bit nervous, she's not going to be the most motivating force. Bear and Barbara are married. One of them is a judge, and one of them is a professor, I think. And the person who's the professor leads most of the class, and the last half of the class after the break is hypotheticals. There are pairs of people in the class. Each person is assigned to a hypothetical, so you do it once in your semester, and the judge leads that and grades that portion of the class. I've heard it's great because you get some practical experience using the cases and the amendments that you're learning about, and it's entertaining.
Has anyone taken the truncated summer sessions, like the 3-week classes? I'm just wondering how that works with, I mean, some of them are 2 days long and one credit, how you're evaluating something in that short of a time period, or if it's recommended that we take it at this stage.
I started nodding before you had finished your question. I have taken summer classes, but none of the really short, you know, intensive sessions, so I'm not sure exactly how you're evaluated. I assume that it's on sort of the same format as a normal class exam would be. But in those summer sessions, you're spending all day, you know, in some cases working with the material and you know, talking about the readings and things. So they're probably much the same, just a little bit shorter. It's difficult to say. If that's something that you're more interested in, would you email me and I'll track somebody down who's done one of those?
I also took summer classes and nodded before you finished that, but I'm taking a truncated class like you're talking about this summer. And I looked at every single short class on the class website to see if any of them described how they would evaluate, and two of them did. And they both said there would be a take-home exam for a short period. One of them said 6 hours. One of them said, like, the last, it was a week-long class, and said the last day of the take-home exam. So it sounds pretty much like an exam/paper situation.
Thanks.
For some of our students who are transferring to full-time, I believe we're taking, some of us are taking summer class, either liberal ethics or pro. What do you think, or which one should you take, or what's better? I mean, some of us have already signed up and they're filled out and stuff, but what do you think?
I transferred and had to take courses over the summer. The first, one summer you need to take a minimum of 2 credits, and one summer you need to take a minimum of 3 credits. If you're doing it and working, then you have your sort of stuff with the evening classes. There are a bunch of them. I would take more, I mean, I took six credits last summer. I took criminal procedure and a course called the Federal Regulatory Process, which is kind of like admin for people like me who think that stuff is interesting. The criminal procedure professor over the summer is awesome. Liz Bowles, she teaches criminal procedure. She's awesome. Jean Shipp teaches legal ethics over the summer. I think his class is either Monday or Wednesday night, so you should be able to take both criminal procedure and legal ethics over the summer.
And work?
I mean, you're doing it now. So it's pretty much going to be the same as what you're doing now. Jean Shipp is considered, if his class fills up first for ethics, considered awesome. I don't have him for ethics, but people love him. So I've heard only good things.
And I took ethics over last summer. Didn't have Jean Shipp. I had Heather Buffabuda. I don't know if she's teaching a section over this coming summer. But I think that taking any class over the summer is great. I mean, it's nice to get, you know, a full semester's worth of material and, you know, grade points out of a 9-week period as opposed to a 14-week period. The summer classes tend to be a little bit more laid back than semester, you know, during the semester classes, it's nice out, you know, people are happy, and the professors are just more relaxed because they tend to have less going on over the summer than they do in during the semesters in most cases. So summer classes, I mean, summer school, you know, when it rolls off your tongue, it sounds terrible, but it actually works out okay. I haven't not been paying attention to the side of the room, I'm sorry, yes.
Just a quick question about spending time during the semesters working versus taking a class, because it seems like a lot of it's in theory in class, and sometimes I'm like, well, I want to know how it is in practice. So if you're going to decide between taking a third or fourth class versus taking an externship or taking just a volunteer opportunity or a paid opportunity or something like that, is there a way to balance it and say,
it's better to do one or the
know, I have worked in a non-legal area and are looking for some more legal experience. I think that, you know, doing an externship and taking perhaps fewer classes might ultimately benefit you more at the end. At the same time, if you already have a little bit of legal experience or have experience in an area that you want to go back into, maybe working at the same time that you're continuing to go to school is not going to be that helpful. And I would also just keep in mind the fact that that is something that at least I personally wouldn't recommend focusing on for next year. You know, those opportunities will continue to exist, and you could probably more easily take advantage of them in your third or fourth year if you stay a part-time student.
I would just add to that for one second that if you think you know exactly what you want to do, I don't think it's a bad idea to get an externship in that field. Better to find out now than the week after you graduate, if you don't like it. And if you do like it, it'll help you make decisions about courses for the and you can use that job as a networking opportunity, and only good things come out of it. If you don't know what you want to do, doing a different externship each semester to try to figure it out is not the way to go. Taking a bunch of courses and figuring out which cases are the least offensive to you is better. And then go to work after that.
And I should also say, now that it's 9:20, we don't have to leave until someone comes and kicks us out. So don't, you know, feel rushed to ask these questions. I'm happy to stay around until people feel like they have as much information as they need. Yes?
How closely do the amount of credits correspond to the amount of work? Like, does it make sense to take, like, 3-4 credit courses and one 3-credit course, or does that not really matter?
It depends on what the course is. The denser courses, even though there are fewer credits sometimes, will end up being more work than 4-credit courses that are a little bit simpler. I'm not sure if that made any sense when I said it, but, you know, it depends a lot on the subject matter. Just like if you were in a 2-credit seminar that was on a particularly difficult or dense topic, it could end up being a lot more work than even, you know, sort of a more straightforward 4-credit course. So it does sort of depend. I think the professors try to design their courses so that they're somewhat proportional in the amount of work to the amount of credits. That at least is how the class hours are based. You know, you're supposed to have approximately 4 hours of class per week for a 4-credit course, and, you know, your 2-credit seminar likely will meet once a week for 2 hours, something along those lines. And the reading, you know, should correspond for as much time as you're spending in class. So I think it breaks down pretty closely, but, you know, it's just important to keep in mind that that's not always the case.
Well, I think, I mean, a 2-credit class is kind of the most deceiving thing in law school. I mean, a 2-credit class can be a lot of work, and it's particularly during the course of the semester, because a lot of times it's a paper. But then you'll have less work at the end of the semester. The same, so you take a bunch of 4-credit classes and you'll have work. So I think a nice work during the semester on your 2-credit class at the end of the semester.
I would just add, you have this experience now. Criminal law versus con law. One's 3 credits, one's 4 credits. Is there a substantive difference in your experience? That's your answer. Yeah.
I was wondering, if we're going to have a particularly difficult semester, or like if we're taking 3 difficult classes, what would be like a good class that, not necessarily an easy class, but something to balance it out more, or maybe the professors are a little bit more generous in grading, just to balance out a bit?
I haven't had that experience yet in law school. So
I haven't either. my summer was pretty easy. You know, I was in federal regulatory process with Haley, and we had, you know, 2 dinosaurs of professors, and they were so nice, and they just talked. They, you know, shared stories. There was barely any reading, and then the exam was really easy. So, you know, that was fine.
They're teaching it again. You should take it.
Yeah, I mean, if you have any, there are a number of reasons why I would suggest that class. If you have any interest in moving into an administrative sort of area, it's a good sort of primer for administrative law, which we're also both taking this semester. And almost everything we've covered in admin, we, you know, got a little bit of a taste of in that class. So that helped. Also, like I said, the professors were easy. It's Jerry Nelson and Gary Edels.
They don't teach at the same time, so you won't be overwhelmed. Yeah. It's a good job.
And they're both hilarious.
Different ways.
Yeah.
I have heard about two professors in particular who teach classes that Professor Robbins and Professor Ramon both recommended, Professor Siegel and Rice for evidence, for BA in evidence. And I've heard just absolute, I mean, they might eat babies, I don't know. but from what I've heard, they may. So my question, I guess, is how bad are they really?
Yeah, I had Siegel. I didn't have Rice. Yeah, Siegel's is really hard. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of material, a ton of material, and the test is pretty hard. But, you know, I mean, we can learn the material really well. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And I mean, she's a great teacher. That's the thing about her. Because, I mean, during class, I mean, she explains everything so clearly, and she's, you know, she's very nice in her class. She's just a small little lady. She's very soft-spoken. She's like your aunt, but she's just a ton of material. But you know, I mean, she is the best BA teacher also we have. I mean, she, in terms of how clearly she explains things and how logically she lays out a lot of things. I think Rice is really the same way. He's probably the best teacher we can know. I mean, his approach is different in terms of he's like he's real screamer and that kind of stuff. But again, he also explains it the best and learns the best. And so depends what you want. I mean, they're both.
First of all, your classmates are going to be sad they left because this is a question no one wanted to ask, so good for you. They call Mary Siegel Bloody Mary, and they're not kidding. You'll know BA. I haven't taken anything with her, but I'm just telling you what I heard because I thought that was kind of the point of it. It's going to be a rough class. I wouldn't take Rice and Siegel the same semester. I wouldn't take civil procedure, criminal procedure, Rice and Siegel. I think you're not going to make it. But, you know, they're both classes where you have to keep up with the work. If you have something going on in your life, or you're working full time, or there's some other kind of major deadline in your semester, make sure that you keep up with the work. I would say, especially in Rice's class. I don't know that you guys have had any, like, really intense Socratic professors yet. If you're someone who you think would be motivated by that, these are both professors who will expect correct answers, and they'll stick with you on it. They're not going to, you know, I don't know, or I didn't get that far, it's not going to work.
Siegel, I mean, she expects what I mean. She's not real, you know, a real intimidating person in class like Grace is. And she, you know, if you don't know yourself, just like, you're on a call, I don't understand. You know, but she's not a real, like, screamer.
If you're someone who's motivated by that, then I know a lot of people who've done well in both of their classes. I also know people who just knew they wanted to take BA, and the other sections were full, and ended up not doing as well as they probably could have if they filled that spot with something else and waited. Your registration lottery situation will get better each semester. So, I know, it will.
No, I didn't know this was diet.
If you want to take BA and the other sessions are full, and you're not interested in experience in this, wait. If you aren't, then that's great, and you'll probably do well. But make that decision consciously. I mean, when Professor Robbins said, consider the professor, it's far more important than what you're learning.
Yeah, I love Steve. She's I think she's good.
Did
you
get
that?
Want to
get
on?
First question is, in terms of like that class that's team taught, that's in the evening.
Yeah.
It's like a 3.5-hour class that meets once a week. How do people generally pursue classes like that? I mean, I've taken that as an undergrad, but is this like torture, or is it better to have it once a week?
You mean the CrimPro class?
Yeah, or just a general class that meets once a week, but you know, as a full 3 or 4 credit class. I mean, is it overwhelmingly painful, or is it great and you get it out of the way once a week and it's?
I didn't take that CrimPro class. The only class I've taken that's once a week is ethics, and it's only 2 credits. So I don't exactly know the answer to your question. But again, I think it's the way you're motivated. I mean, if you're, like, for example, I have ethics at 10:30 on Wednesday mornings, and I do not start reading before 8 o'clock on Wednesday mornings. I keep the books in my car. I haven't looked at ethics other than that morning, and now my ethics professor will probably hear this podcast, but, you know, if that's how you're going to treat it, if it's 3 or 4 credits, consider how that'll reflect on the exam. And that may be great for you. It's not going to be great for me, I'll tell you that. But if you're someone who will, you know, do the reading a few days before, really seriously think about it, you'll probably get through that class a little more effectively than I do.
Okay. But I mean, is 3.5 hours, you know, law class?
It's only a break.
Yeah, there will be a break, if not two.
And then my second question, in terms of the drop ad period, I mean, I like buying my books way in advance. I like having my books. I like getting into the books. And if you drop a class, I mean, you just, you know, lose the money that you would have spent on the books. Like, how do you approach a class if you're going to register for your maximum credits and approach them all to the same level and then get rid of them? So what's your advice on that?
That's a good question.
What happened to me the first semester I registered?
I think if you... speculating here. I think if you buy your books early for a class that you ultimately drop, I think you still can, in most, at least most cases, return the books for some sort of some refund.
Like, start highlighting them. Obviously.
No, I know. Or I mean, you'd have to sort of keep that in mind. If there's a course that you think you might drop, you know, don't write in the book before the end of the drop ed period.
I did. I took BA with Wallace for one day and fell asleep on the first day after a very relaxing summer. And decided it wasn't going to go well and switched into tax. But I had to sell the book back as though I'd used it the whole semester when I'd written literally in the on the front cover the assignment for the day, and that was my only marking in the book. It sucked.
And then conversely, I mean, if you realize, you know, within the first, you know, within the ad drop period that you want to add a class and you haven't been sitting in on the class, would be there a huge detriment, like having missed?
I don't think so. I mean, if, you know, you'll get the syllabus from the professor when you transfer in, you'll have to put in a little bit of additional effort to get caught up, but not certainly not detrimental at all.
I would add to that, though, if you come into a class late, fight for the seat you want. When I went to tax after that, it was the only time I ever switched a course, sat in the back row, couldn't really see the board, really didn't understand what was going on. Sitting way back there allowed me to do all kinds of other things other than trying to figure out what was going on, and I should have fought for the seat that I thought was open because it turned out to be open.
Just tell people you
go
have
for
a
it.
Site issue.
Yeah. Do whatever you have to do. Tell your professor you want to add a chair to the row. Whatever it is, fight for the seat you want.
Yep, no problem.
Okay. It's Jeff's turn.
Sorry.
Oh. Yeah. Sorry. He won't stand up for himself, so I will.
This is along the same lines. Since we're on it, sounds like almost all of us will take evidence, business associations, federal tax. Who... In that category, where the professors just that can't teach.
Can't teach?
Don't teach well.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, in evidence. Professor Jones, who has a great reputation, is really entertaining. She's really nice, but she teaches all in hypos, pretty much. So, like, you'll walk into the room, and she assumes you did the reading, and she moves on with a hypo. She's not going to call on someone and say, now brief this case, and then let's talk about a story that might be related to this case. So if you're someone who in the last four major classes you've taken has never written down a hypo that the professor has said, that might be an issue for you. Because you're not likely to have many class notes if you don't write down hypos. And the hypos are what end up on the exam. So think about, like, that's one thing for evidence. Other than that difference in her teaching style from Rice's teaching style, I've heard she's a great professor, but be aware that that's her style is much more conversational. It's not as traditional.
And I had Jill. She, she's really entertaining in class, and I mean, I think she's a good teacher. You learn, you know, definitely hearsay very well. And you know, you learn the rules and you kind of put bars in it very well. She's a tough grader. She's a very tough grader. She's probably an upper grader than Rice.
Really?
Yeah, she doesn't give us any low grades. She doesn't give the low grades that the rest does, but she's about to get the high grades in the rest.
You said BA in tax, right?
I don't know anything about any tax professor other than Pike and Ventry. They teach very differently. Ventry is, I had him myself, and he's very energetic. He bounces around. He's really funny. He uses a lot of examples. Pike is a little bit more monotone, but is very focused on tax policy. So if you're someone who doesn't love numbers, Pike's someone who's going to be a little bit easier to understand why you got to the place you are and maybe plug it into the exam a little bit easier because you'll have a lot of information about the purpose of the statute. So it'll be a little easier to figure out when to use it. Ventry's like a mile a minute. He's like the micro machines man, but he's really funny and entertaining. And if you do the reading and pay attention in class, there's a good chance you'll do well.
Yeah, I think of all the major kind of subjects, I think we have the best probably tax faculty. I don't think you can go on anywhere with that.
just heard about the distinction between Siegel and Wallace for BA. Siegel's a little intense. Wallace is a little bit. He used to play in the NBA or something.
He was the first black guy from the
SEC.
Pretty cool.
Wallace bored you to death? Wallace bored you?
We're talking about Perry Wallace, the bean.
Oh,
does he bore me? Yeah, terribly.
Yeah, and also the first class.
That's his thing. He's really nice, but sleepy.
He's kind of susceptible to boredom. So, Haley is kind of susceptible to boredom, so take that with a grain of salt.
I have two questions. The first one was, can you tell us which courses are more writing intensive that are not seminars for starters? And also, can you tell us which professors are really disorganized, like don't have syllabuses, don't use computers, that type of
thing? I'd like to take this question first. I have David Hunter for environmental law.
And while we do have a syllabus and a casebook, there's not really any reason for it that I can tell. I mean, it's lots of anecdotes, lots of, you know, good stories, talk about environmental policy, talking about current events and things like that. We have not been discussing the cases that we're supposed to read. We don't cover all the statutory sections that we were assigned to read in class. That said, it has still been one of my favorite classes in law school so far, just because it's so interesting. But, you know, as far as disorganized professors go, Hunter certainly would be on the list. And, you know, because this is being recorded, I really do like the class. And I have learned some things, but I'm going to have to study a lot for that exam. I don't know of others that are that way. I think it'd be pretty hard-pressed to find a professor who didn't have at least a reasonable syllabus for their class posted, you know, somewhere before the class starts, or at least that they give you at the beginning. Some will be better than others, but I've got to think that everybody has one.
Isaiah Baker, though, doesn't.
I should say, for those of you who are remaining here, federal courts is a great class to take, but not before you've taken civil procedure. They told me I didn't need it. They were wrong. I did need it. So take it after you've taken civil procedure. But if you choose not to take that advice, you're just looking for a smaller semester.
Yes?
What's your experience in terms of either visiting professors or adjuncts in terms of the quality of the teaching?
I've had very good luck with both. I think, you know, perhaps the only complaint that I would have in that department is Professor Thirschwell, that I had for criminal law, was a visiting professor, I believe, at the time that we had him.
Mm-hmm.
And he still is, as far as I know. And I didn't have a good experience with criminal law, but I think it was only because I really didn't like criminal law. So, you know, that was my bad visiting professor experience. I've had several adjuncts. My criminal procedure professor, Graham, was an adjunct. She was fantastic. I actually had a really good adjunct for rhetoric, too. So my experiences so far have been pretty good in that department.
My experience with adjuncts is mixed.
And I'll just add one more thing, is that I think if you're taking classes, if you're interested in a class that has an adjunct professor, you might just look into see how long they've been teaching that class here or at other places. You might have better experiences with people who have a lot of teaching experience but just aren't full professors, you know, people who are still working but like to teach and do it frequently. Who's brand new or only teaches sporadically.
Family law and immigration, have you taken any of those or do you know anything about?
I haven't and I don't.
I know a little bit about family law.
Okay.
But I haven't taken it myself.
But you know.
And I should say, too, at the same time that, you know, particularly on my end, because I'm, you know, still only a 2L leaving student, I haven't taken as many courses as my fellow colleagues. So if you have questions like that and still need answers to them, email me and I will direct you.
one more question. Civil procedure, between civil trial and criminal trial, and like between these skills courses, I mean, which one have you taken?
I haven't taken either. That's another
one that I can't comment on. Did you take either of those yet? Either a civil trial, a trial advocacy or appellate advocacy, criminal or civil.
I've heard great things about all three advocacy classes.
I don't think you can go wrong with any of them because they're so active and sort of real world client focused. But I don't have the details.
They come out of like real programs with a program director who monitors all the faculty. They're smaller programs than rhetoric, so, and they allow for a lot of discrepancy between classes. So some of the sort of tension that you felt like with your rhetoric professor potentially trying to fit rules that didn't really fit them doesn't happen. The only thing I would caution is if you don't like group work, you'll need to do group work in all of those classes and in clinic as well. All of that requires that you work with at least one partner, usually bigger groups than that. It usually makes at least one person in the room turn their nose up, so I figured I'd say it. But
yeah.
I've heard
oh my God.
Yeah, all of that requires group work to some extent, and writing to some extent. But you have to realize we're like, what, number 4 in clinic in the nation, so take advantage. 2? Yeah, take advantage of it. I mean, we're famous for our clinics. And we have an evening clinic, if any of you are staying evening students. General practice clinic has an evening section in the fall and in the spring. It's one of the only schools you'll find that allows evening students to participate in clinic, so.
Yes?
Professor Core, who we have for civil procedure. You have Core for civil procedure. Yeah. I just know the name. I know what section he taught in. So if you want more information, we can get like a blurb from her from the dean's fellow that we can send to you. So give Scott your email address.
Was Core the integrated curriculum center?
Yes.
He really doesn't like the integrated curriculum program. But that doesn't apply
to
you
anymore.
Which
is fine, because you're done after today. So.
But yeah, you have an email. Email me, and I'll connect you with somebody. Yes?
Have any of you done an externship seminar?
Nope.
Nope.
Okay.
A lot of people do that, but yeah, we haven't.
The same thing. If you have specific questions, feel free to send them out.
All I can say about the externship seminars is that they're mostly pretty fluffy. Don't get concerned.
That's my question. How much time do they take up, really?
Well, yeah, and I think most of them have, you know, some reading assignments. You might have like a journal entry responsibility, and then some sort of paper to prepare at the end. But I think as you're going along, and simulations. But you know, I think the professors recognize for the most part that during the externship period, you should really be concentrating on the work that you're doing for your externship. So they keep you going and try to keep you focused a little bit on the seminar, and there are some work involved, but it's probably not much in most cases.
If you read the Metro, you should be able to take care of the reading.
I just wanted to ask if you guys could discuss a little bit your experiences with, I know Scott, you probably have gone through the fall recruiting process and how that plays in the fall with classes and other things, like where you might have to be away. Hopefully you're away for a few days interviewing for jobs and things like that, and how you thought that impacted the semester.
I'm interested in your talk.
Because I'm doing it now.
Oh yeah, it's a big time commitment, actually. You'd be surprised how much time it is, because I didn't actually travel anywhere, and it was still, United States, Washington, but it was still a big time commitment. So that's definitely something you ought to think about when your schedule is kind of creating that, particularly going to travel somewhere. At first, it sounds like
And if you are able to spare the time over the summer, I would recommend, based on what I've heard about it and plan to do myself, taking as much time over the summer to get your research done for the firms that you want to apply to. Then hopefully, if you get interviews with the firms that you've already researched pretty sufficiently, you'll be able to concentrate on just getting ready for the actual interview rather than having to do background research, and at the expense of other things.
I would also just add that you should find syllabi of the courses you want to take with the professors you want to take them with in past semesters on the registrar's website, or email the professor and ask for the syllabus. If they have like a you must sign in all but 3 days of the week, you'll probably use your 3 in fall recruiting, mm-hmm. and that's a little rough, unless it's an evening class, because most places won't come in. Who knows? But look for the syllabi, because if it's specific. specifically mentions class attendance that could get a little tricky.
I think you mentioned it already, but can you talk about race for evidence? Did you say no?
I didn't have any maintenance. He signs a lot of reading and he tries to be real intimidating science and that kind of stuff. I guess the biggest obstacle is just the amount of material he has. So that's the biggest problem. A lot of people kind of get intimidated by the way he conducts class, but he doesn't agree on participation in the student. If you have to care, it doesn't really matter. But
he's just not nice about it.
Yeah, he's just not nice about it. But the biggest problem, it's just a lot of material. So, if you don't know the material, then he will get bad grades, like very bad grades. Yeah. So, which a lot of your professors don't really dip as low as he will. So.
And I've heard, though, about Rice's class that people who had him really did learn evidence well for the bar exam in particular. I mean, if you do well in his class, you will have...
the one who has, like, a cutoff for failing people? He failed a certain percentage.
He fails people, but he doesn't walk into a room and he's like, I'm going to fail five of you. He just fails people who don't have material. I would also...
if you do well, you'll know it. Also, if you learn material, not people do well in this class. Yeah. A lot of people.
He wrote the book, so people find that when they're called on, he knows every single word in the book. It's like the 25th edition of his book. So, he knows what he's asking. He's not going to be, looking to see where you got that piece of reasoning. So it can be a little intimidating. And he's kind of rough, with the class. He's not sweet about answers. But if you're not motivated by someone saying, that was exactly the right answer. Great job. And instead, you're motivated by being like, yes, I got it. It might be okay.
Sorry, so for the part-time evening, you need 8 credits, right? And CrimPro and CivPro is only 7. So you do need to take a third course. But taking something like evidence is going to be too much. So what do? You take a real, a 2 credit or something?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how to answer that question.
You can take 11.
I know, but working full time, I couldn't take a third course now. So, I mean.
Oh, I see.
Well, you took rhetoric. And
rhetoric,
it was fine.
Yeah.
What?
And you balanced it just fine, and that was a 2-credit course.
Right, so 2 credits possible, but I'm not seeing a lot of. Okay, I'm just trying to think, do I take. I'm obviously going to just have to take a seminar or an elective of some sort, not a third, core course or.
What's available
because
CrimPro and
CivPro
will take a lot of your time.
Yeah.
So.
But you need one more for sure. Yes.
That's right. Question. Sorry. This is just not a list because you are in spells. Have you, Professor Vermeil's exam, I'm wondering how to approach it because he discussed it tonight and it seems like he doesn't have the Iraq method and he wants something different, but I don't know exactly what he wants. Do you know
what? We had him for Kamala.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't recall getting that sense when he talked about his exam for our class. Has he provided you with a couple of his practice exams?
I think he said it's not Blackboard, so
okay. I would recommend obtaining those, reading them, writing them, and paying very close attention to sort of how things are structured. While it's fairly certain that the questions won't be exactly the same, they will be very similar in terms of their structure. There will be perhaps a statute that's proposed that you have to determine the constitutionality of that's education related, or perhaps reproductive rights related, or something like that, or a combination of all of those things, or whatever the case happens to be. But I don't think that. Perhaps it's just not as straightforward as you might see on some exams where you have questions that have an issue that you then just analyze and draw a conclusion from. You're going to have a very, very long fact pattern with lots of different issues. And in those issue spotter questions, you still will want to be applying some sort of IRAC analysis or the correct cycle type analysis that you learn in rhetoric to all of those issues in your discussion. And I also assume that he's still doing his the short answer portion of his exam, which is fairly interesting. Well, I mean, it was different because it was, you know, it was a long period of time. I thought they were relatively difficult questions.
They were specific.
They were very specific, and you had to have your handwrite them, which is terrible. So that, you know, that was unique.
All I would say about Professor Ramil's exam is that it's long.
It's very, yeah, it's very long.
And you'll have a very long fact pattern, but why don't I go? Yeah, it's very long. Stick around. We'll talk about it more when we're done. Whoever's interested, talk about it. Still wanna.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very long.
It's long. But it's very, like, it's actually reasonable. Like, if you go through and you do what your professors have taught you, like, underline all the stuff you want to talk about in the issue and, you know, go issue by issue in your exam and do a real analysis of each, it's not hard. It's just really long.
Anything else? Yes.
I mean, is it going to be better than Popper? I wonder if I should just wait for a semester that Popper's teaching out of the fall.
I don't know. I haven't had Lovers for anything.
And I had Lovers for Adam Lai. He's a pretty dry, you know, lecture. And, had to zone out a lot and that kind of stuff. But I mean, his exam is pretty straightforward issues about her. I mean, Popper, I have help. I don't know, I tend to think, I don't know, I can envision him getting real philosophical and kind of I mean, I had reports, but, you know, that's definitely not Lovers. And so Lovers, I mean, if you learn the rules, which, you know, Admin is a very kind of rule-based thing, I mean, if you learn the rules, you know, Lovers exam, again, it's a, you know, normal, kind of difficult issues, but it's not really what you got, it's just straightforward issues.
We have Verona right now for Admin. You guys had them for contracts, right?
Yeah.
You know, Admin, I'm really into administrative law, and that's kind of what I want to do, and it's really boring anyway. I mean, it's boring stuff. But Verona's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, jazz hands and everything.
Really, when you're talking about
stuff you can't imagine is actually law in this country, and he's...
I think Verona's the jam for Admin. That's
or Popper. Popper's probably good.
I think Popper would be great for Admin, too.
I would take anything with Popper.
Yeah, I'm trying to find easier, greater.
They'll all be about the same. Graders. Okay.
Anything else? Well, as always, I probably should have also said this before we got started, but if you have any other questions, feel free to email me anytime. If I don't know the answer, I will find someone who does.